family-friendly daytime festival on Saturday, noon to 5 p.m., featuring vendors and music. More event information at BemidjiPride.com. Weather tonight, partly cloudy, lows near 53 degrees, northwest winds up to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny.
Hello, I'm Catherine Cullen.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Trade-offs. Prime Minister Mark Carney says he's removing retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods that comply with a continent-wide trade deal, prompting some kinder-than-usual words from Donald Trump. But the former leader of Canada's Conservative Party tells us, despite what the president may have said, it remains to be seen precisely what he's willing to do.
And come rain and shine. A Philadelphia rapper says this weekend's Bald Fest is all about celebrating the culture. No cap. Unless you're not bald, and then they'll give you a bald cap.
Those stories and more coming up on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. On the Rivers, our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. We receive support from Itasca Economic Development Corporation, creating and retaining quality jobs in Itasca County through education, research, and connections with businesses. Working to help grow small businesses of all sizes and strengthen our local workforce. Learn more at itascadv.org. Now I'm going to play a song for you. It's a new one from Al Nicole. The song is called You and Me, featuring Aaron Ray.
Take my heart. You had it anyway from the start. When I'm alone, my luck runs dry. When I'm with you, I'm ready. I watch our love grow.
Again, that's You and Me by Al Nicole featuring Aaron Ray.
Hello, I'm Catherine Cullen, sitting in for Neil Cooksell.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
discount your blessings. Prime Minister Mark Carney drops a lot of Canada's counter-tariffs on American products, leading to questions about what direction exactly his elbows are pointing.
Reality Check. A Toronto psychologist has developed an app he says can help people experiencing auditory hallucinations determine whether what they're hearing is real or imaginary.
A real trailblazer. We remember activist Richard Lee, who died last month after a life spent taking huge risks to make a point many now take for granted that cannabis should be legal.
All heads on deck. A rapper in Philadelphia looked in the mirror, saw a receding hairline, and reacted in the usual way. He organized what he hopes will be an annual bald fest at a local skate park.
Yacht Rocks. A retired British physician dove into dinosaur fossil research for fun and ended up discovering a whole new species that had a giant sail coming out of its back.
And on the lookout, or lack thereof. Former passengers sue United and Delta Airlines for boldly stretching the definition of window seat to mean a seat without a window. As it happens, the Friday edition, radio that guesses their travel experience was relatively painless. For months, Canadians have rallied behind a tough, elbows-up approach to U.S. trade talks. But today, Prime Minister Mark Carney highlighted a key characteristic of elbows by bending. He announced that Canada is removing all retaliatory tariffs on goods that are covered by the Canada-United States-Mexico Agreement, or CUSMA, but there will still be tariffs on steel, aluminum, and vehicles. Here's the Prime Minister today answering a question from Kyle Duggan of the Canadian Press.
Your critics are going to say that this is an elbows-down approach, that you're backing down to Trump. What are you gaining by dropping these tariffs?
So the first thing to say is, let's be clear, we have the best deal of anyone in the world right now. We have the lowest tariff rate on average, a little over 5.5% versus that 16% average for the world, and in many cases much higher. It's important that we preserve that. The second thing is, and I'll take your analogy, and I have played some hockey over the years. And there is a time in a game, in a big game, and this is a big game, when you go hard in the corners, your elbows up. The time in a game where you drop the gloves in the first period and you send a message. And we've done that pretty uniquely in the world. But there's also a time in a game where you want the puck, you want a stick handle, you want a pass, you want to put the puck in the net. And we're moving later into the game, and we're at that time in the game. And that's where the engagement is.
Canada is hoping that the concessions on tariffs will help jumpstart trade negotiations with the U.S., which have been at an impasse in recent weeks. Aaron O'Toole is the former leader of the Conservative Party. We reached him in Ottawa.
Aaron, I'm not sure if you've played much hockey, but do you agree with the Prime Minister that it might be time to get those elbows down for the sake of winning the game?
Well, I played hockey. I was a left winger, believe it, right winger in politics, I guess. And I know Mr. Carney was a goalie. I've never liked the elbows up phenomenon, Catherine, to be honest. I've said smarten up. There's going to be times where we can be tough, but there's going to be times where we have to do things not based out of emotion and based out of strategy. And I think some of the retaliatory tariffs that we put on the U.S. were hurting our manufacturers, hurting our supply chains more than the U.S. So I think what Prime Minister Carney did today was actually acknowledge we had a few goals on our own net under the end of the Trudeau government. So he's resetting the score and basically going to the final round of negotiations to find common ground.
You, I am sure, are aware that there are a variety of reactions to this, and some folks certainly do not see it as a reset or the right move. Pierre Poilievre, leader of the Conservative Party, now calls this extraordinary weakness. He accuses the Prime Minister of broken promises, saying that the prime minister promised he would be elbows up, that he would handle Trump, that he would negotiate a win. And this is just another concession. What do you make of that assessment?
Well, I think part of what Pierre is saying is absolutely right. Prime Minister Carney set expectations very, very high that, you know, look at my business pedigree. I'm going to be the guy to get a deal. Well, there's no deal. And, you know, we're now getting into several months of waiting for a couple of pucks in the net, to keep that analogy going. But I do say, compared to the government of Prime Minister Trudeau and Prime Minister Carney, you can even tell by the tone of Donald Trump's press conference today that at least there's a more serious approach from Canada, less of the virtue signaling, less of the progressive agenda, and more of let's talk Turkey on steel, aluminum, let's build ships together, let's guard the Arctic together. That's going to drive a deal, not posturing, because you have to deal with the personalities in the negotiation, and President Trump is a unique personality.
That is certainly the case. He said today, in part, quote, "We are working on something." This is Donald Trump. "We are working on something. We want to be very good to Canada. I like Carney a lot. He's a good person." You know, Mr. Polyev said, "Well, no wonder Donald Trump is happy. Canada just dropped counter tariffs." What do you read into the way President Trump is talking about this?
Well, look, I've also said, remember, there's pressure on President Trump. Obviously, we're the mouse living next to the elephant, but the elephant is making some very bad moves on trade. And so there are slowly inflationary pressures rising up. The president is probably going to lose his so-called fentanyl and these other emergency tariffs because there's court challenges that could be complete in early fall. So the president's in a bit of a race against inflation, a race against the auto industry losing billions of dollars over the last quarter. So we're not rushing for a deal, but if we're going to make a deal, we can't be antagonizing with the retaliatory tariffs. And to be honest, last fall I said, don't put the retaliatory tariffs in. It's going to hurt our manufacturers more than theirs. So banning the sale of Kentucky bourbon, that's fine. That doesn't impact a manufacturer in Guelph or in Lethbridge. But retaliatory tariffs across the board does. So I think what Prime Minister has done today is basically an admission of previous mistakes.
And yet there are sectors that continue to face strong tariffs from the United States and Canada: auto, steel, aluminum, forestry sectors. What would you say to people in those sectors today who see these tariffs being dropped, but no relief for them?
Well, we should back them up. We should have their back. And I'd include Catherine Potash as well, who are not being tariffed by the Americans, but by the Chinese, because we're coming into line with the Americans on manufacturing-related tariffs on steel and aluminum. So for a time, we should be providing some relief for these sectors. So many sectors aren't covered by Trump's tariffs because of the USMCA deal, but that expires next year. So we need a serious plan, and the prime minister start putting a few pucks in the net.
I wonder, we heard the prime minister say there off the top in the clip, we've got the best deal of anyone in the world. He is, of course, talking about CUSMA, the new NAFTA, because he hasn't negotiated a new deal. What do you make of the way that he's framing that?
Well, we're lucky that CUSMA is limiting the application of general tariffs that President Trump wants to apply on everyone. So I think ultimately Trump wants to get to an area where he'll charge a low general tariff to make a little bit of money, but try and find a number that won't disrupt the economy. So this is what I think Canada's strategy needs to be in the final step. Don't do any retaliation. Try and get Trump down to a low amount, like a 10% tariff that we could probably live with. Our dollar would be more stable, and that would almost make up for that difference. And the sweetener for us is, I think we need to propose defense partnerships or an energy partnership or energy collaboration as a bit of a sweetener. Let him position it as a win for the Americans, and we both leave happy.
To what extent do you think Mark Carney is doing that right now? We don't know what's happening in, for instance, that phone call on Thursday, but Mark Carney has talked more broadly about the economic and security relationship and resetting it.
I think he's doing quite a bit. You know, I really admired the fact that Prime Minister's only trip to Canada before calling election was to Iqaluit. As you may recall, Catherine, I used to say we needed to make our NATO 2%. We needed to do more in the Arctic. People kind of found me amusing a few years ago when I said that. The prime minister is now doing it. And I think Americans are paying attention. But I do think the Prime Minister has set the expectations so high for Canadians that Mr. Polyev's right. You know, people are going to want to start seeing some proof here. So I think we need some action by September. We need to hold fast as a country, support Team Canada, but let's get some wins.
Aaron O'Toole, thank you for your time today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
We reached Aaron O'Toole in Ottawa. In the 2010s, you might have seen Richard Lee in his wheelchair, wearing a sweater with the tongue-in-cheek logo for the pro-cannabis university he founded called Oaksterdam. And to make sure you got the point, he'd have had multiple pro-legalization buttons pinned to that sweater as well. Mr. Lee, an influential American cannabis activist turned successful pot businessman, died last month at the age of 62. He became one of the most well-known evangelists for pot after suffering a debilitating accident. Throughout the 1990s, he risked arrest and jail time by brazenly growing cannabis in Texas and shipping it to medical patients in California. In 2010, he sat down in front of the cameras from Fora TV to debate marijuana legalization with a California police chief. Here's a clip.
Well, first question I'd have for the police chief is, does he think if we made booze illegal, our social costs would go down? I mean, do we want to return to Al Capone and Thompson submachine guns, driving around, you know, shooting each other over selling alcohol? We didn't legalize alcohol because we said it's a totally safe drug, it's a wonderful drug that everybody should use. We legalized it because making it illegal was worse than making it legal. And that's my view with cannabis, that by bringing it into a tax and regulate scheme that we can bring in tax dollars for the government and we can try to mitigate some of the social costs a lot better than we can with it illegal.
And of course, Richard Lee eventually won the day when California and many other states legalized first medical and then recreational marijuana use. Dale Sky Jones was a close friend of Mr. Lee. She's the executive chancellor of Oaksterdam University. We reached her in Oakland, California.
Dale, it sounds like your friend was pretty feisty about this fight.
Indeed. Richard was beyond feisty. He was irreverent and knew that prohibition has failed all of us, regardless of your political stripe. And one thing we believed in was whatever you cared about, we could connect the failure of prohibition and where those resources go to your issue, whatever it happened to be.
Let's go back a bit. Tell us about the accident that set Richard on the path to cannabis activism.
Yes, because Richard was a cannabis enthusiast before his accident. He was a roadie working as a lighting technician for Aerosmith, and they were doing a pre-concert rehearsal in New Jersey. He was up on some scaffolding. He wasn't really high, but he was high enough that when he fell and he had a screwdriver tucked into his tool belt in the back, he said, "Dale, if I didn't have that tool belt where it was, I'd have gotten up and walked away." But he didn't, because it crushed several vertebrae. And suddenly cannabis was the only medicine that helped excruciating nerve pain from the accident, something that opiates not only he didn't like, but gave him terrible side effects.
What kind of risks was he taking in the 1990s by promoting and supplying medical cannabis?
Well, he started by supplying medical cannabis to the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative, the OCBC, which wound up in a Supreme Court battle, the first to go all the way to SCOTUS to be decided. And that's when Richard stood up and said, "All right, I'll take the flag." He firmly believed that we were in a war. And make no mistake that when he was raided in 2012 and he was stopped by the federal government, that if he had continued, the continuing criminal enterprise charges that would have been brought against him would have been enough to earn him the death penalty here in America.
But in the end, there were no charges brought against him.
Right? None whatsoever. And remarkably, the case is still sealed, even though we've asked several times, "Hey, why did you come raid us and forcibly retire our founder?" Nothing, just pages of black out, no information.
You've given us a strong sense of his activist streak, his public persona. What was he like as a friend?
brutally honest. You could always count on Richard to tell you exactly what he thought. And I appreciated that. He would also apologize when he maybe went a little too far, which is just precious and rare that someone will, on their own, walk up and say, you know, I was rude, or I might have made a mistake the other day and I own it, and then just move on. He was selfless and generous. When someone came in and said, let me work with you, he's like, no, I'm going to show you how to do it for yourself. You go do it. And how can I help?
People would call him from jail for help.
Indeed. One friend, Andrew Glazier, told me recently that he, you know, you get one phone call from jail, and Andrew finds himself in jail as his wife is going into labor. And instead of calling his lawyer, he called Richard. Richard showed up, had him bailed out. Andrew was not only home in time to see his daughter born, Richard refused repayment and said, no, you need to just pay it forward.
How do you think he changed the cannabis legalization movement?
He was the cannabis legalization movement. When we put quality training for the cannabis industry on Oaksterdam University's wall, he got attacked because this isn't an industry, this is a movement. He says, no, we have to be taken seriously as an industry. Before Prop 19, which was the first to ask the question about adult legalization, and that became the election heard around the world. That sparked the debate about cannabis policy reform and prohibition, not just here in the United States, but across the world.
And obviously we see now so many states that do have at least some form of legalization. Do you think there was any part of him that missed the old sort of under the radar fight days?
Well, I know that was never a fan of oligarchies and monopolies. He was always for the little guy. He wanted small business to bloom, and tens of thousands came to Oaksterdam, over 100,000, to learn how to start their own businesses. I think what Richard would be disappointed with is how long it's taking, and would like to see cannabis regulated more like hemp, that it would be free and fair. And he didn't want the overtaxation. He believed in smart business, and he was a Republican from Texas. So he recently, right before he passed away, he was taking care of his mom, and he just didn't get out much. And he had left and started seeing all the stores in Texas, all these hemp stores that look just like the dispensaries out of Oakland. And he called Jeff, my husband. His mind was blown at how far we had come. But I fear, I don't mean to get biblical, but like, he's like Moses leading us to the promised land. And now we're just on the verge of finally descheduling, hopefully not rescheduling, but descheduling cannabis. I'm just sad he's not here to see what he's really done.
Dale, my condolences on the loss of your friend.
Thank you.
We reached Dale Sky Jones in Oakland. When your hairline starts receding, sometimes your confidence can recede a bit as well. But when you look up at your scalp, Robert Capron wants you to feel like things are looking up as well. Mr. Capron is a rapper and the organizer of a new festival in Philadelphia, honoring and celebrating those who haven't lost hair. They've gained stature. It's called Bald Fest. We reached Robert Capron in Philadelphia.
Robert, you have only recently joined what you call the Secret Society of Baldness. What is that?
If you'd have asked me that 2 months ago, I'd have said, I have no idea. But it's just like this like interconnected community. I'm walking down the street and like I'll see another bald person, and there's like a lock. It's like you'll instantly lock on to them. They'll lock on to you. They'll give you like a little head nod, or they'll give you a little fist bump, or just like they'll just speak to you in general. And I said, before I shaved my head bald, I never knew that type of like community was being held between bald people.
Was it a tough decision to go ahead and shave your head?
Oh, it was really tough because hair is so connected to our personal identities. And I was so connected to my hair, and the idea of going bald was so frightful to me.
There has been some discussion, I will say even in our office today, about what actually makes you part of the bald community. If you shave your head, are you really bald? Where do you stand on that?
I don't know, because that makes me feel conflicted, because that makes me feel like baldness is a punishment, or it's like sacred right that you have to kind of fall into. You know, I think if you shave your head, you still can claim baldness. You know, you still can claim a small section of bald culture.
All right. So let's talk about Bald Fest. What inspired you to organize this?
So after I shaved my head, I made a TikTok video. And in the video, I was talking about just my newfound confidence of being bald and like how I felt like all my peers and everyone around me is telling me that I'm looking so good. And around July 4th, I put out an EP. Like, I make music in my spare time. And the EP wasn't really doing too well as far as like getting people to listen. So I was just thinking, like, how can I combine my viral moment, my newfound bald confidence, and also kind of showcase my music at the same time? So I was like, I'll just do a festival. I'll bring all the bald icons together. And then at the end of it, I'll do a big show.
So for those of us who do have a full head of hair, are they welcome at Bald Fest?
Oh, they're welcome. And if you guys are feeling FOMO from all the ball like activities, I'm gonna have like ball caps for all the, you know, for those who want to live vicariously through us, you know. So I'm partnering with a good friend of mine. If there's someone there who's feeling it, they can go to the barber, take a seat in that chair, and change their life forever.
You mentioned earlier bald icons. You in fact, I understand, have a list of some of the best bald heads out there.
Yes, I have my bald Mount Rushmore.
Okay, walk us through it.
So I'll give you the latest version, which is like 7.0. Number one, the icon himself, Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. I think when you think of like baldness in the 90s, he just carried it for the culture for the whole 90s up into the 2000s. Number two, Pitbull.
Mr. Worldwide.
Mr. Worldwide. That's the fact that like so many people go to his concerts, dress up as him, put a ball cap on. Pitbull is just like the definition of like pushing the positive ball narrative. Number three is like my dark horse. A lot of people don't agree with me, but it's Sir Patrick Stewart. He's like the classy ball gentleman. You know
Captain
what I mean?
Captain Picard.
Like, yeah, absolutely. You know, he is for our distinguished gentleman. I'm so conflicted about the last one. It was Mike Tyson for a long while. I think he's like bald now, but he wasn't bald like at his height, so I had to take him off the list.
Okay.
So now, who's number four? That's why the list is ever changing. right now, let's throw Howie Mandel up there, you know? Let's throw Howie Mandel up there.
Okay.
I feel like he makes the bald and sunglasses combo look so good.
I believe he's a Canadian too, so we're happy to get a little spot on the ball.
Show you guys a little love.
Okay, but see, just how torn you are about this raises a significant question. What makes a good bald head?
One, it has to be perfectly round, you know, like perfectly circular, you know, spherical. Mm-hmm. Number two, it has to be shiny, right? I think like when people think of baldness and bald heads, you think of like a shiny bald head, like a natural, like, magnifying glass, you know, to reflect the light back. So we're going to crown best in ball tomorrow at Ball Fest, and we're going to go off of roundness, we're going to go off of shininess, and we're going to go off of overall bald appeal. So just, like, what catches your eye? Because you can have the roundest head, you can have the shiniest head, but it's all about how you're carrying your own baldness.
Okay, so then this leads me to ask you, I hope this isn't too personal, but how would you rate your own bald head?
So I think I'm at an 8.5. I'm like, everyone who sees my head, they say I have the perfect head shape for it. I have the confidence to carry the bald head, and I'm proudly becoming the face of the common bald man. So I have to have a pretty good bald head, you know?
Robert, this is pretty funny stuff. I do love the Mount Rushmore of baldness, but I guess I'm still trying to figure out, like, how much of this for you is about like laughs and having a good time, or is there like something really profound at the heart of all this?
So I think a big part of this is just making sure that everyone's having a good time, everyone's having a good laugh. But also, it means a lot to me because there are a lot of people reaching out to me. There's a woman reached out to me saying that like she's bald due to her chemo treatment, and that like seeing this type of support just makes her feel so well. And I talked to another individual saying that they're like through a lot of research for alopecia, and that the bald community is very forgotten. So it was a mix of both. It's for the laughs, but it's also, it has an undertone of seriousness and an undertone of like real community.
Robert, it was really nice to meet you. Good luck with the event.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Robert Capron is the organizer of BaldFest, which is taking place this weekend at Gray's Ferry Crescent Skate Park in Philadelphia. We reached him there earlier today. And now it's time for our regular segment, Words Case Scenario. Words Case Scenario. Scenario. Now, that theme really gets across the simple fact that words are scary. Take, for example, cleave, which means to split or to adhere, essentially opposite meanings. Oversight means watchful care, but also an accidental error. Or when you say you dusted a cake, you could mean you swept the dust off a cake or you sprinkled dust on a cake. We all know these words that are their own opposites or contronyms, but answer me this question. Really quietly, so no one hears you talking to the radio. What is a window seat? Now, imagine you're saying, a window seat is a seat by a window, Einstein. Well, I understand why you're lashing out. It is self-evidently a seat by a window. But did you know that window seat can also mean a seat with no window? I didn't either. And a number of American airline passengers are not delighted by this newly invented contronym. They're suing Delta and United Airlines. They want their money back because they paid extra for window seats and got seats on the side of the airplane where a window would have been had a window been there, which was not. The plaintiffs say the airlines didn't warn them that their window seat might not have a window, and that they themselves never considered that possibility given their very literal understanding of the original meaning of window seat, i.e. a seat that is next to a window. We'll keep an eye on this fascinating case, which proves once again that the English language is endlessly evolving and words can mean what they mean or what they don't mean. All definitive definitions are out the window, whatever that is. Here's Nutrients with Window Seat. With window seat.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, inspired by an unusual number of rescue stories on As It Happens this week, we'll revisit a conversation from our archives in which the owner of a Great Dane explains how he rescued it from a tree.
And Seek and He Shall Find, a physician turned paleontologist, tells us why he spent his retirement digging through dinosaur bones and how it feels to have discovered a whole new species.
Stay tuned. I'm Catherine Cullen.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Thank you.
It is 6:35. It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Deborah Ann. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses like smart biz, managed voice and Wi-Fi services, security cameras, and more. Online at paulbunyan.net. Paul Bunyan Communications. It's right here. And we receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy. Lows near 53 degrees. Northwest winds up to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny. High 62 to 67. Breezy northwest winds. Overnight lows in the upper 40s.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Catherine Cullen.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the Friday edition, part two. These days, technology isn't typically all that helpful when it comes to discerning what is and is not real. But a new app promises it will be helpful, and it's targeting a very specific group of users. It's called A4I, or App for Independence, and it was developed by a team of software engineers and physicians. Its primary function is to detect auditory hallucinations, and it was designed for people who experience hallucinations. Its creators say it can help them determine whether what they're hearing is real or imaginary. Dr. Sean Kidd is the clinical psychologist who came up with the idea for the app. We reached him in Toronto.
Dr. Kidd, can you describe what people experiencing auditory hallucinations may be going through?
For sure, yeah. So about three-quarters of people with schizophrenia will experience auditory hallucinations. And so an auditory hallucination is essentially an auditory experience that the individual experiences as a real sound. So they hear it just like you or I or anyone might hear a sound outside themselves, except that sound isn't outside of themselves. It's produced by their own brain. And usually for most people, auditory hallucinations take the form of voices they hear talking to them or yelling at them.
And obviously, I can only imagine that must be very destabilizing.
Yeah, for a few reasons. So, many people, even with medications that are working, can experience these still. So they tend to be persistent, and at best, they're distracting. You know, you're trying to do a task, talk to somebody, and you have these voices happening at the same time in your head. And at worst, they can be really distressing and scary, where, you know, the voices are saying terrible things, frightening things. There are many different personalities happening through the voices. And so it can be very distressing and really contribute to people's challenges functioning in the day to day.
So the idea is that your app will help them through these moments. How?
The hallucination detector, as we call it, what it does is it visualizes sound. So you're able to activate that function on A4i, the app, and it shows you visually a visual representation of the sound that's around you. So you're able to decide whether or not, using this tool, whether or not, you know, is a voice represented there? Is there a sound visually there or not? And that helps you decide whether it's in your head or not.
When you say visually represented, is it sound waves? What do they see?
Yeah, it's pretty much like sound waves. Like many people might be familiar with oscilloscopes or, kind of like a line that does squiggles when a sound happens. So that's exactly what it is. It's actually fairly simple. And it just shows you the sound that's around you. So you're able to make a call as to whether or not, you know, is that an actual sound around you? Maybe it is somebody talking loudly in the hallway, or is it something that's probably an auditory hallucination?
And then what do they do from that point? Or this is just sort of a check to help calm them?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a check. So you're able to indicate it was a hallucination, yes or no, what did I think it was? So you're able to, it can help you get better at being able to discern a hallucination from an outside sound. And that's a really important skill to have in the recovery process, because the better you are at being able to say, that's a hallucination, I can ignore it and set it aside, I'm going to focus over here. That's a really important skill. And then as well, the technology too, if you got it wrong, if you thought it was a hallucination but it wasn't, or vice versa, it gives you some tips as to how you can get better and what skills you can use going forward.
If somebody is having this distressing experience, are there any concerns about them actually trusting what the app is telling them?
We haven't come across that. I mean, some people might choose to not use the technology at all. It might not see it as something relevant for them. And we don't know too much about what their experience might have been. But the people that have tested it, and we've tested it widely in Ontario, it's being implemented widely as well in Riverside County, California. We hear one of two things. One is the person doesn't really have auditory hallucinations, isn't troubled by them, so they just don't use that feature of A4i. And for those that do use it, they find it quite helpful, and many people use it regularly. It's helpful at honing that ability, as we'd intended, to discern real sounds from auditory hallucinations. And it's not too surprising. Like, we spent a lot of time with people with schizophrenia co-designing, so building this together, learning from them as to what's useful and not. So really, their input was core to the design.
And where did you get the idea for the tool?
Yeah, so it came out of something that, frankly, was a bit frustrating as a clinician. So, you know, we all know that if you're a little bit anxious or experiencing anxiety, want to be more mindful, you have hundreds and hundreds of apps of different kinds you can readily get access to. But there was a young man I was working with clinically. He had schizophrenia and had really disturbing voices. And he'd bring in his phone to our sessions sometimes and just play ambient sound that he'd recorded and saying, "Do you hear something here? Is somebody yelling in the background?" So he was trying to use his phone to do essentially what A4i does. And I looked around, I did a search, and I saw that there was almost nothing out there in terms of digital tools for people with an illness like schizophrenia. And so that led us down the road, like it's just an obvious gap, led us down the road to build A4i.
As we've mentioned, this is something that happens through healthcare providers. What's your hope for the app?
Yeah, so ultimately, we've got to do a few things. So one is we've got to use evidence. So it's a situation, unfortunately, with digital mental health where well over 90% of technologies have no evidence whatsoever of their effectiveness. And that's really problematic when you're kind of advertising and putting tools out in the world that may not work and may waste people's time. So we're trying to validate what we're doing with evidence, show that it's feasible, show that it's having positive impacts. And alongside of that is really getting out in the world and communicating with providers, because ultimately we don't intend a person with schizophrenia to ever pay for A4i themselves. Ultimately, it will be hospitals and various healthcare providers and administrators that will get licenses to this and then can just make it readily available in their clinics. So a big part of our work is making the networks of clinical leaders and organizations aware of its presence and finding paths where we can make it available.
Dr. Kidd, thank you very much for this.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Sean Kidd is the Psychology Division Chief and a Senior Scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. We reached him in Toronto. She's trying to remember her son's life, not the horrifying and still inconceivable moment of his death. Last night in Toronto, dozens of people gathered at a memorial for Gervais Roy. As we heard on Monday, the 8-year-old boy died on the weekend after he was struck by a stray bullet while lying in bed. Holly Roy is Gervais Roy's mother. Here's some of what she told the crowd at last night's vigil.
I thank everybody for coming here. It really is lifting my spirit, keeping me present. I wish this on nobody. It's an indescribable pain. I wish on no one. But I feel the love from my community, my city. I feel the love and support, and I thank everybody for reaching out. I've got some messages, you know, Gervais gained thousands of aunties and uncles. When he was here, that's how he was. You know, he's such this energetic spirit that people gravitated to him, and he had aunties who weren't biologically his aunties, but they're like, you know, they're just adopting my son because that's who he was as a person. Everyone, he just wanted him. I came here and I was like, I'm gonna be strong. I'm gonna say everything I need to say. He can watch over me now from up there. And I'm gonna hold that that's who he was when he was physically here. I don't want his memory to be tragic. I want his memory to be good, because he was a really good little soul, way beyond his time. He was actually an advocate against violence. And I'm still trying to wrap my mind around. I've been advocating for years for violence prevention. And I'm still trying to wrap my mind why he was stolen from us. But I'm gonna take that and use it as a fight to make change in his honor, and his name is gonna be honored.
Holly Roy speaking at a vigil for her son, Javé Roy, last night. Jeremy Lockwood was a medical doctor, but since he retired, he's looked at more bones than he ever saw while he was working. After his retirement, the 68-year-old started a PhD in paleobiology. He loves dinosaurs, as evidenced by the fact that he spent hundreds of hours looking at fossils. And now his enthusiasm has paid off. He's discovered a whole new species of dinosaur. We reached Dr. Jeremy Lockwood in Chale Green on the Isle of Wight, England.
Jeremy, tell us about this new dinosaur of yours. What would it have looked like?
So this was an iguanodontian dinosaur. The iguanodontians were herbivores, and they were around for a long time, maybe, you know, sort of 90 million years. So this one actually was about the size of an American bison. They were sometimes called the cattle of the Cretaceous, and we think they gathered in herds. A distinguishing feature about them is they had a thumb spike.
You say a thumb spike. Is this the line of little spikes that goes along its back?
No. It's their thumbs were a spike.
Oh.
But often quite small spikes. They would have been probably not much use in fighting off a predator. They could have been to help them with foliage or something like that. It's a little bit mysterious as to what the thumb spikes were for, but it defines the group.
Part of the reason that your discovery is attracting so much attention, though, is this sail, it's called. Describe that for me. Help us see it.
Well, it's one of the things that struck me about this, first of all, it was when I was looking at it, was that the neural spines, the extensions of bone that sort of protrude from the top of a vertebra were really quite tall. And that set us off doing a study, and we found that the neural spines started to become much taller at the junction of the Jurassic and the Cretaceous periods, about 145 million years ago. And that's when these animals were changing from being fairly small bipedal animals into much bigger herbivores that started walking on all fours, so that tendons, a crisscross network of tendons, went along them to brace the spine. But we noticed in this one that it was too big for that. It just didn't seem possible that was all about mechanics.
And so the reason it is called a sail, I imagine, as very much a layperson here, is because it does give the effect in the artist's rendering I've seen of looking almost like a sail, like a sailboat on the back of the
dinosaur. Well, that's what we think it was. So what we think's happening is that as birds have tail feathers, they really need their tail feathers to fly, to steer, and to brake. But if we take the peacock, it's a really rotten flyer. But it's got this huge tail. And we think we're looking at sexual selection, so that when they're looking for a mate, this is what they're looking for. These extraordinary changes, which are evolving, but they don't actually have a function.
Well, part of the interesting mystery, I suppose, as you were putting it, around this dinosaur, these are fossils that were first found in the 1970s. How important was that sale in realizing that, in fact, these particular fossils were something unique that you had discovered and not just a previously known species?
Yes, the height of the neural spines was very important, but also there are other changes in the skeleton that suggest that it may have had a very S-shaped neck, and things that we don't see in other iguanodontians. So we're pretty sure this is a distinct species.
What do you remember about the moment where you realized, wow, we have a new species here?
It's a really nice feeling, because I think I was going through hundreds of iguanodontian bones, and if I found out that there was no difference between them, it would have been good for science, but it wouldn't have been quite such an interesting way of spending the last 6 years.
Now, you decided to name it, and you're gonna correct me here if I don't get this right, but the Istiorhachus macarthurae. Why?
Yeah. Istion is the ancient Greek for a sail, and rachis is ancient Greek for the spine or backbone. Ellen MacArthur, Dame Ellen MacArthur, is a very famous sailor on the island. She broke the royal record for going round the world non-stop solo sailing. And Istiorhachus, 125 million years ago, admittedly, also lived in the same place and had a sail on its back. So there was a link there. And I did ask her if she minded. So,
what did she say?
She seems very, very happy with it. It's nice to have a dinosaur.
It's fascinating. I mean, you live in this, what is increasingly understood to be this dinosaur hotspot. Mm. But you had a whole career as a physician, and then you decided to jump into this PhD research on dinosaurs. What possessed you to do that?
My wife will ask the same question, really, because, I'm starting to paint the house and everything now that I finished it and get the garden in order. I used to teach a lot of junior young doctors, and once you retire, you can't carry on teaching or doing anything. That was a shame, but I'd always been intrigued that there was dinosaurs really all the same, or were they different? So some of the differences, I thought, did look as though there were new species. I mean, I used to love dinosaurs when I was, 60 years ago when I was 8. It was a bit unusual to like dinosaurs then. So, yes, it was rekindling a passion of mine. And it seemed a good idea to do a PhD as a formal way of learning.
What would you say to your 8-year-old self about the fact that you ultimately ended up discovering this new species of dinosaur?
I think my 8-year-old self really delighted. I've still got a piece of bone that comes from Morocco that my father gave me, and it was a dinosaur bone, and it was always by my bedside as a little boy. It was my treasured possession. So it is nice when I think of that. All these years later, I'm naming a dinosaur. I'm very lucky, very lucky.
It's a moment 60 years in the making, but also 125 million years in the making.
Yes, also that too.
Well, listen, Jeremy, congratulations, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this.
It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you so much.
Dr. Jeremy Lockwood discovered a new dinosaur species that lived on the Isle of Wight in England, and that's where we reached him. It's not always intentional, but occasionally we will find that certain themes will resurface over various episodes of As It Happens. We've been known, for example, to conduct multiple pizza-related interviews in the span of a month. We're suckers for a good world record and a bad world record. Sometimes these are patterns of our own making, and sometimes they're just a function of life as it happens. Like this week, on Monday, we told you about eight fishermen who'd been rescued off the coast of Newfoundland. On Tuesday, we brought you the story of a hiker rescued from a California waterfall known as the Toilet Bowl. And last night, we heard an account of how some 60 campers were rescued from BC's Bugaboo Provincial Park. They were all harrowing experiences. But few rescue stories have been as nail-biting as that time Wes McGurk's Great Dane disappeared, and he had to mount a surprisingly high-altitude rescue. From our archives, here's his 2016 conversation with guest host Laura Lynch.
Well, I got back from having pizza in Omaha and came back to the house of a friend of mine, and we said our goodbyes and came into the yard, and I saw one dog, which is my roommate's, the little Labrador, and so I just, all right, went home, went inside, and, you know, said my hellos, say, how's it going, and looked in the office, which she usually is in the office if she's not outside, if I'm not home. She wasn't in the office, so I assumed she'd be downstairs. So I opened the door and went downstairs and realized my dog wasn't in the house at all. She wasn't outside. No sign of her anywhere.
You must have been getting worried by then.
Oh, you bet, you bet. I was like panicking. I was like, man, where's my dog at? I heard a whimper, and I thought it was a Labrador. I was like, nah, it couldn't be. So I heard it again above me. I was like, wait a minute. So I shined the flashlight up in this big, giant 100-year-old tree, and there she was, like 20 feet off the ground.
20 feet off the ground?
20 feet up, yeah, up in the air.
And she's a big girl, huh? She's 125 pounds?
Well, 115, 120. First thing I did, I had to whip up my cell phone and take a picture like everybody does. And then we decided to go find a ladder, which got me to the top of the center trunk. And I did crawl up there. And I looked at her and was like, okay, Cora, calm down. You know, she was cold, she was shivering. I was like, we're not going to get her off of that. So let's call the sheriffs and report this, which we did.
Did they take it seriously?
Not at first, no. They didn't believe it. But they sent two squad cars out anyway and, you know, slid the gate open. They drove in. It was like, well, just point your lights that way, gentlemen. And they did. And they're like, huh, he was right. There is a Great Dane in the tree. I just couldn't believe it. So first thing they did was they pulled up their cell phones and they took pictures. Well, they called the fire department in Lewisville, and they were already occupied, so the other town on the other side of me responded from Plattsmouth with a ladder truck, and a tanker came out, and an ambulance just in case, I guess, anybody would fall off the tree. They called a canine officer to come out there because she needed a harness, which I didn't have. So we took the harness from the German Shepherd to put on the Great Dane, which was a really tight fit. And I guess about halfway down it broke, but she fell on the tarp and everything was okay.
Good Lord. How are you going to stop her from doing this again?
I think she's learned her lesson. Yeah.
From our archives, that was Wes McGurk talking to guest host Laura Lynch about rescuing his Great Dane Cora from a tree in 2016.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens where